Members, the Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice will come to order. We're running a little bit late. I apologize to the public for that. We're still waiting for a few members to come. So we're not at quorum yet, but we should be at quorum soon. In the meantime, members, if you look in your packet, you'll see the committee rules and procedures that I've crafted. And Chair Johnson, I believe we forward those to you to take a look at prior. You know, pretty standard. You know, most committees have already presented their rules. You know, the big issues with rules tend to be have to do with amendments and the manner in which amendments are expected to be presented in terms of timeline, and then also some room of flexibility for the chair to be able to work with changes in the amendments. My expectation is that those would be pretty minimal, but as I said at the very beginning, you know, this is where law gets constructed in committees, and so we owe it to ourselves to give ourselves a bit of flexibility relative to shaping things. Sometimes that means changing a word here or there. Sometimes it means asking a couple of members to go off to the side and work something out and then bring it back. And so my promise is to be as flexible and as adaptive as possible, but at the same time, ensuring that we've got a good transparency dynamic going here, and that's why we want those amendments in as early as possible. So with that, members, please review those, and if you have any concerns, certainly bring that back to me.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have quorum now.
Are we at quorum?
Yeah.
All right, so we'll establish a quorum, and then Representative Constant, I think you have a motion for us.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes. Would like to delete the word first in the first paragraph, and then delete Chair Mariani began the meeting at 5:50 p.m. as it's being redundant, and I would move the minutes with those corrections.
Very well. So Representative Constantine moves the minutes of, what's the date of this? January 17, 2019. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Constantine. So today, members, we're going to hear from three distinct groups, our Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It's my hope that we'll spend a good chunk of our time with the Sentencing Guideline Commission. And what I'd like to do, frankly, is to have them move through their presentation without interruption, so that they can get through it, because they're going to cover a lot of ground here, and I think it's important for us to listen carefully. At the same time, though, please signal to our committee staff if you have a question, and then we'll back up the conclusion of their presentation to go through those questions. So I'm hoping to basically carve out about 40 minutes for this interaction, 20 for them to present, and then 20 for us to ask questions. And then we'll be moving into a quick conversation, 20 minutes, to get an overview of the structure and the funding of probation structures in Minnesota. And then we'll finish the day with another 20 minutes hearing from the Rubina Institute. And so I'm going to ask our presenter for the sentencing guidelines to come forward. And in the meantime, Representative Johnson has a question.
Chair Mariani, one thing I'm looking at the rules, and I want to make sure that we have something in there to make sure that any amendments are posted on our page so for the public to see.
Representative Johnson, the amendments certainly will be posted on our website. So you have my commitment to do that. It's certainly been a custom and practice here, and certainly something I embrace. If it's of comfort to you, I could certainly add it into the rules and then represent them back to you all. So let's make a note of that and do that. Thank you, Representative Johnson. And so with that, at the risk of butchering your last name, sir, I'm going to welcome Mr. Nathaniel J. Wrights.
Yes, sir.
Oh, wow, I did it. Who's the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission for an overall presentation, and I think you heard me earlier in terms of how I hope to be able to carve up our time. If that's a problem, let me know. I want to make sure you're sharing what you feel you need to share, At the same time, I want to make sure we have a good ample time for questions for you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nate Wrights. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I will do my best to adhere to the timeline. I will say that it'll start to look like a movie rather than a slideshow toward the end as we go through some of the data presentations. But take comfort in knowing that all the information that I'm going to present to you, almost all of it, is found in the 2019 report to the legislature in greater detail, and you're welcome to refer to that. You should have all gotten a copy of the report to the legislature when we published it on January 11th of this year. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to present to you today an overview of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. This presentation will be divided into three parts. First, an overview of the commission and the sentencing guidelines. Second, a look at the process by which the sentencing guidelines are modified, with a particular emphasis on the 2019 guidelines modifications, which the commission submitted to you in its January 11th report to the legislature. And finally, an overview of Minnesota's felony sentencing practices in 2017, which is the most current year for which we have data, with a special emphasis on the effect of the 2016 Drug Sentencing Reform Act, as called by the courts. So we'll begin by discussing the sentencing guidelines in general, as well as the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and its role in modifying the guidelines, and highlight other topics that may be of interest. The legislature established the Sentencing Guidelines Commission in 1978, and the first sentencing guidelines were promulgated and permitted to go into effect in 1980 by the Minnesota legislature. It is the first state in the nation to have a Sentencing Guidelines Commission and sentencing guidelines, and other states and the federal government followed suit in the years that followed. The guidelines are in place to establish rational and consistent sentencing standards that promote public safety, reduce sentencing disparity, and recommend sanctions that are proportional to both the offense and the offender, while respecting the finite correctional resources of the state. By law, the commission has been given three policy roles. First, the commission is charged with meeting as necessary for the purpose of modifying and improving the sentencing guidelines. And it is in furtherance of that duty that we made the recommendations to you in the report to the legislature this month. Second, the commission responds to legislative action in the area of crime and sentencing policy. For example, the commission reviews each new felony that may have been enacted in the previous legislative session to determine the severity level ranking that will be assigned to it. Third, the commission is required from time to time to make recommendations to the legislature regarding criminal law, procedure, and sentencing. Just briefly talk about what the staff does, the full-time staff that I oversee. The legislature charged the commission's full-time staff with serving as a clearinghouse and information center for sentencing data. Because of this, the commission is able to publish various reports on sentencing practices in general, as well as sentencing practices for particular classes of cases. We have specialized reports, for example, for drug offenses, sexual assault offenses, and assault offenses in general. We also compile sentencing information on demand, responding to 375 individual data requests a year. This is a service we provide to the public, particularly criminal law practitioners, but of course we can provide that to legislative staff or legislatures as well. And for each felony crime bill, we participate in the fiscal note process by providing an estimate of the prison bed demand that will be created by the change to criminal law, or reduction in prison bed demand, as is occasionally the case, and that becomes part of the fiscal note process. We also provide demographic impact statements for bills that meet our threshold criteria. In addition to our role as a sentencing data clearinghouse and information center, we obviously also support the commission's research needs as it does its policy work in modifying the guidelines. Finally, we process and ensure the accuracy of over 18,000 felony sentencing records annually, answer over 250 phone calls and emails monthly from practitioners with questions about how the guidelines work, and train over 350 practitioners annually, either in classroom settings or online. The 11 seats on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission are designed to represent a wide variety of criminal justice stakeholders. The three judicial seats, which are shown in green on this chart, are appointed by the Chief Justice and represent the three levels of Minnesota's judiciary. The five seats shown in dark blue represent other stakeholders appointed by the governor: public defenders, prosecutors, the Department of Corrections, law enforcement, and probation. The three seats shown on the bottom row are reserved for members of the public, one of whom must be a felony crime victim. Those public members, as well as the designation of the member to serve as chair, are also appointed by the governor. And I will point out what is unusual in the guidelines currently is that the chair was appointed by the governor, but he was appointed to the commission by the Chief Justice, and that's retired Associate Justice Christopher Dietzen. The point I'd like to make on this slide is that there's a wide diversity of viewpoints.
Chair Lesh, yes, we're going to wait to the end, but we'll put you on the list. Absolutely. Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Rates.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. With the diversity of viewpoints that's on the commission, I'd like to point out the significance of the fact that the recommendations and the guidelines modifications that are submitted to the legislature this year were all made unanimously. So for the next few slides, I'm going to talk basically about the mechanics of the sentencing guidelines, how the sentencing guidelines actually operate, and I'm not assuming a particular level of knowledge going into this conversation. What the sentencing guidelines do is they establish a presumptive sentence for felonies committed in Minnesota. At the heart of the guidelines, this is a series of two-dimensional grids. The standard grid is shown on this slide, and it's reproduced along with the drug offender grid and the sex offender grid at the back of your handout. The vertical axis represents offense severity. The more severe the offense is, the longer the recommended prison sentence will be, and the more likely that executed prison as opposed to probation will be what's recommended by the guidelines. We'll talk about the vertical axis on the next slide, but just as an overview, the horizontal axis, which we'll talk about in two slides, represents the offender's past criminal history. Like offense severity, the recommended sanction will be more severe as the criminal history increases. This slide talks about that vertical axis, which is offense severity. There are three sentencing grids: standard, sex offender, drug offender, each with its own severity level ranking. Although the commission has left some offenses unranked, the vast majority of felonies are assigned a severity level ranking on one of the grids, the idea being that all offenses assigned the same severity level are approximately equally severe and should be receiving equal sentences depending on the offender's criminal history. Criminal history, as I've said, is the horizontal axis. It has four components to the criminal history score. The higher the criminal history score, the farther to the right an offender moves. Most of the 2019 modifications had to do with the criminal history score, and most of those changes had to do with the custody status point of the criminal history score. But the custody status point is not the biggest contributor to the typical offender's criminal history. As shown on the pie chart, over the past 3 years, over two-thirds of the average criminal history scores consisted of felony points. Each prior felony is assigned between a half a point to 2 points, or if it's a repeat sex offense, sometimes 3 points. And 1 point will move the offender one square to the right on the grid. The custody status point is the second most common component, contributing over a quarter of the average criminal history score. This point is assigned if the offender was under some form of custody status at the time he or she committed the current offense. Custody status, contrary to what might be implied by its name, can include non-custodial situations, such as being on probation, which is very common. Many prior gross misdemeanors and some misdemeanors will contribute a misdemeanor unit. If you get 4 misdemeanor units, that totals 1 criminal history point. Typically, only 1 misdemeanor unit is allowed. The juvenile point contributes only 1% to the average criminal history score. The commission did nothing to modify the juvenile point in the 2019 recommendations. To understand much of what we're going to talk about at the end of this presentation, when we talk about the sentencing data, it's important to understand the concept of a departure. So the guidelines, as I said, recommend a presumptive sentence, but judges don't necessarily have to follow the presumptive sentence. if the judge is able to articulate substantial and compelling reasons for departing from the sentencing guidelines, then the judge may do so. And I say the judge because it is the judge's decision, but in many cases we find that it's not the judge acting alone. Defense attorneys, victims, prosecutors all contribute to the judge's ultimate recommendation, and oftentimes a departure from the guidelines is with the agreement of the prosecution and the defense. By far mitigated departures, that is where the defendant receives a sentence that is less severe than what the guidelines recommend, are more common than aggravated departures. Aggravated departures represent about 2% of all cases, whereas mitigated departures represent over 22% of all cases. Departures can take two forms: dispositional, which is the prison, no prison decision, or durational, which is a prison duration that's longer or usually shorter than the duration that the guidelines recommend. We'll be using this terminology later when we look at the sentencing data. I added this slide after hearing Chairman Mariani talking last week about his interest in probation guidelines. For 40 years, there has been statutory authority for the commission to create guidelines for offenders for whom imprisonment is not proper, although there are a number of requirements that the commission must follow if it chooses to go down this road. Since 1981, the commission has chosen not to go down that road, at least not at this time. I will say, though, that the commission is currently discussing the development of its future work plan. One of the topics that was raised by the chair recently was whether the commission should explore the apparent lack of uniformity or geographic disparity with respect to the length of probation terms, and several members seem to have expressed an interest in exploring that topic, but that has not been resolved at this time. Next, we'll be discussing briefly how the sentencing guidelines are modified, with an emphasis on the 2019 proposed modifications and recommendations that I've been talking about. We will not be discussing the 2019 modifications in great detail. This is something the chair and I spent about 45 minutes before the Senate Judiciary Committee talking about last week, and I'd be happy to come back later and talk about them in greater detail if time permits before this committee as well, Mr. Chair. The Commission's primary consideration in establishing and modifying the sentencing guidelines is public safety, which the Commission interprets to mean protecting the public from crime. The Commission's examination requires it to balance the important purposes of sentencing, which are retribution or punishment, incapacitation, deterrence, restitution, and rehabilitation. In doing so, it must also factor in the important public policy goals of uniformity, proportionality, rationality, and predictability in sentencing. The general guidelines modification process by law depends on a couple of different things. It depends on whether or not the commission is acting on its own initiative to make a change to the sentencing guidelines grid or other major changes to the guidelines, or whether it's making a minor change or reacting to what the legislature puts forth. Commission initiatives to make substantial guidelines modifications, such as the one that the commission is proposing in 2019, must be submitted to the legislature by January 15th. Those initiatives automatically take effect on August 1st unless the legislature by law provides otherwise. So in other words, the commission's action will take effect unless you intervene. On the other hand, less substantial commission initiatives, as well as commission implementation of legislative initiatives, are not required to be submitted in advance to the legislature. They must, however, be reported in the Commission's next annual report to the legislature. After its two-year study of criminal history and the sentencing of repeat severe violent offenders, the Commission on December 20th, 2018 unanimously adopted a proposal to amend the guidelines. The proposed changes fall into three major categories: one, waiver of the custody status point in certain circumstances; two, other changes to the criminal history score, for example, changing the decay factor so prison cases don't decay before probation cases; ending custody status upon discharge from probation, even if that was early; and other changes to the criminal history score; and third, the enhanced sentencing of repeat severe violent offenders. In terms of prison beds, what will be the impact of this package of guidelines modifications? The sentencing enhancement will add the need for some prison beds, but staff estimates that this will be more than offset by the reduced need for prison beds caused by changes to the criminal history score. Staff estimates that these modifications will eventually result in the net need for 536 fewer prison beds. Some of these estimates are difficult to make. For example, although we know how many past cases would be eligible for the custody status waiver, we really have very little idea how frequently judges will choose to grant the waiver. And like nearly all changes to felony sentencing policy, the impact will take some time to be felt. We estimate that these changes will not be fully realized until the end of fiscal year 2040. On a different but very related topic, when do sentencing guidelines modifications take effect? The Commission's answer since 1987 and the legislature's answer since 1997 has been that they take effect prospectively, that is, to crimes that are committed on or after the effective date of the change. This results in a very clear rule for MSG staff to GC staff to train, for minute programmers to code into the electronic worksheet system, and most importantly for attorneys, judges, probation officers, criminal defendants, and prospective criminal defendants across the state to understand and apply in practice. That rule is, and the Commission maintains should continue to be, that you use the guidelines that were in effect on the day the offense was committed. That rule was thrown into question in 2017 in a Minnesota Supreme Court case called State v. Kirby, which left the door open for certain types of guidelines changes to apply retrospectively to certain defendants whose cases had not progressed past a certain point in the criminal justice process at the time the change was finalized. The Commission is making legislative recommendations as a result of the Kirby decision to keep the existing policy in place. To be clear, the Commission is not recommending any legislative action with respect to the proposed 2019 sentencing guidelines modifications. As I said, those modifications will take effect unless the legislature by law provides otherwise. It is the Commission's unanimous request, however, that the legislature amend Minnesota Statute 244.09 to make it clear that the guidelines modifications are prospective. The resolution to this effect is found in Appendix 4.2 on page 76 of your report to the legislature. And I will say that with respect to this recommendation being unanimous, I am certainly not a spokesperson for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, but the County Attorneys Association has made it clear in their public testimony that they do support this package of modifications, but their support is conditioned on prospective application of these modifications. Mr. Chair, I may be out of my time already. I do have a final section to present, which is an overview of Minnesota's felony sentencing practices in 2017.
Mr. Wright, you're doing pretty well, actually, I have to say.
I will keep rolling, Mr. Chair.
6 minutes or so?
So the first graph that we have here is the number of offenders who were sentenced in the past 16 years or so by offense and by type. And you can see that there was a decline in offenses sentenced from 2006 to 2010, but it's been rising ever since then. The number of felony offenders sentenced in 2017, which was 18,288, was the highest volume on record, surpassing the previous record set in 2016. It was an 8% increase from 2016, and it was the largest year-to-year increase that we saw since 2003. At 31% of all cases sentenced, drug offenses for the second year in a row remain the largest offense category sentenced. This chart shows the year-to-year change in offenders sentenced. You can see that there was a four-year period of decline in the late 2000s, but the number of offenders sentenced has been rising every year since then. So this shows the rate of change, basically, every year. This chart, and I apologize, it's probably too small to read, shows the percent change by offense type from 2001 to 17. And I want to point this out because I'm going to be talking about the impact of the Drug Sentencing Reform Act later. To understand the impact and why it may not knock your socks off as much as you might think it should, is because you can see that the number of drug cases has been on the rise for a number of years. In fact, since 2011, the 2.5 increase, there's been a positive change in the number of drug cases every year since since that year. So whereas other types of cases have gone up and down, drugs have been consistently rising, although the rise in 2017 was smaller than it's been in the past, and perhaps that's on its way down. We will see. This chart shows the distribution of offenders by race and ethnicity. In 2017, 57, and I should say it's over time, over the entire period that the guidelines have been tracking this information. In 2017, 57% of offenders sentenced were white, 25.5% were black, 9% were American Indian, 5% were Hispanic, and 3% were Asian. The percentage of offenders who are white has decreased by roughly 25% since 1981. This is largely due to an increase in the percentage of black offenders, although the percentage of other non-white offenders, particularly Hispanic offenders, has also increased over time. This chart shows the distribution of felony offenders by race and judicial district. The map of judicial districts is at the end of your handout, if you'd like to refer to that. As far as the near proximity goes, the second judicial district is Ramsey County, and the fourth judicial district is Hennepin County. Those are the only two districts that are coextensive with one single county. And those are the two districts you'll note that have the highest percentage of black offenders in them as well. This next slide shows incarceration rates by gender and race or ethnicity and total. So you can see that the top bar shows that 92% of offenders get some sort of incarceration at the conclusion of their felony sentencing event. That could be local jail, it could be prison. Another way of saying that is about 8 walk out of their felony sentencing event without any additional incarceration. Having said that, the green bar at the bottom shows the percentage of offenders, and I will point out that it's fairly uniform across demographic characteristics, ranging from 88% to 94%. But there's not quite so much uniformity when it comes to the felony imprisonment rate, which is shown on the bars at the bottom in green. This chart shows incarceration rates by judicial district. Less uniformity with the total felony imprisonment rate. I would describe that as a little more uniformity with respect to the felony imprisonment rate, geographically speaking.
Mr. Rates, I'm going to violate my my don't ask a question. I'm sure I have several members are also squirming, like, why did the chair not allow us to ask questions right away? But I do want you to back up here. And so this is, you know, again, the chair role modeling the thing about there's no such thing as a dumb question.
Yeah,
I'm lost between what an incarceration rate and an imprisonment rate is.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the incarceration rate includes the imprisonment rate, and then the rest of it would be made up by local confinement rate. So essentially, if you're to picture the white space from the top of the green to the top of the blue, that is made up of people going to jail or other local confinement. I didn't put the local confinement rate on here because I think the felony imprisonment rate is more important. It's longer durations, and it has more to do with what the guidelines are about, frankly, since we don't have guidelines for local jail.
Correct. Thank you.
So we're moving on to the slide called Mitigated Departure Rates by Gender and Race or Ethnicity in 2017. So we talked about departures, and we talked about mitigated departures. I did break it, I'm sorry. Wait, first day. So this is, colloquially speaking, somebody getting a break. And there's two ways of getting a break. You could get a mitigated dispositional departure, which means you didn't go to prison, even though the guidelines recommended that you do go to prison. Or a mitigated durational departure, which is where you went to prison. In this case, we're isolating cases where the offender went to prison, but the judge didn't send you to prison for as long as the guidelines recommended. So two different ways of getting a break. So you can see here that among the mitigated dispositional departure rates, there's certainly the high spot is among females. Females get dispositional departure rates at a much higher rate than males do, 56% to 34%. Although they get mitigated durational departure rates at a slightly lower rate than males get. Likewise, there's some variation among other demographic characteristics regarding mitigated dispositional and durational rates. What I find interesting on this chart is the black offender category, which has one of the lower mitigated dispositional departure rates, but one of the higher mitigated durational departure rates. Not doing so well on getting a break in one category, but doing better on getting a break in another category. Now, sort of freeze that thought in your mind as we look at the next slide, which shows the geographical variety of basically sentencing practices in different jurisdictions. You'll recall that we said that the second and fourth judicial districts also had some of the highest concentration of black felony offenders. So here you see that the sentencing practices in the second and fourth judicial districts tend to favor mitigated durational departures more than any other districts in the state by quite a bit, which may account for some of that variation in durational departure rates that we saw in the previous slide for black offenders.
Mr. Wright's another violation here of my own rule. Black African immigrants are counted as black, but what's the guideline for the?
These are demographic characteristics that are given to us on the sentencing worksheet that we receive. They're typically inputted by the probation officer. We don't have any sophisticated guidelines for inquiring of that. For example, Hispanic, even though under census categories, Hispanic is not a racial category, it's an ethnicity that can apply to any racial category. It is treated, it frankly has never been changed. It's been treated as a racial category on sentencing worksheets, I think since the beginning, as long as they've been tracking it. And so that is considered its own racial category as well. There's no category for multiracial. Although in looking at census data, it looks like Minnesota has a reasonably small number of multiracial residents compared to some other jurisdictions. But I don't know. It's not a terribly sophisticated category, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed, Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is looking at the mitigated dispositional departure rate. Again, just for presumptive commit cases, which is where it really matters. And looking at some of the higher, the offenses that get the highest dispositional departure rates. There's a identity theft. The commission's ranked in severity level 8. That is the highest mitigated dispositional departure rate. Over half of the offenders get a mitigated dispositional departure for that offense, whereas the total rate is 36%, where if an offender is recommended prison, in 36% of the cases there will be a mitigated dispositional departure in 2017. The second highest is assault in the second degree. And I will point out that assault in the second degree, which is assault with a dangerous weapon, does not necessarily require injury. Could be merely threatening another with a dangerous weapon, is always a presumptive commit case. And that is because under statute, under 6911, the legislature has required a prison term for all assault in the second degrees, as well as a number of other offenses involving a dangerous weapon. But because assault in the second degree always involves a dangerous weapon, it's always a presumptive commit case. And we see a 54% mitigated dispositional departure rate. The other offenses that have a dispositional departure rate of 41% or more for presumptive commit cases are also shown on this slide. This is high durational departure rates. The offenses in blue are offenses for which offenders receive durational departures more often than average. The total durational departure rate is 22% mitigated durational departure rate. We also show on the left here in the green offenses where there's a high aggravated durational departure. This is the first time we've been talking about aggravated durational departures or aggravated departures of any sort. This is where offenders receive a longer prison term than the guidelines recommend. We're going to now switch to talking about the 2016 Drug Sentencing Reform Act. This is not a name that you gave it. This is a name that the courts have pinned on it. Made a number of significant changes to sentencing of Minnesota drug offenses. Generally, these changes took effect August 1st of 2016 and were made effective for crimes committed on or after that date. In 2017, which is the last year for which we have data, only about half of the cases, the drug cases that were sentenced in 2017, were subject to the DSRA, even though it went into effect August 1st of 2016. That's because about half the cases were committed before August 1st of 2016. So because we still haven't really seen a complete year's worth of data, we ask that you consider all the results that we're about to show you to be preliminary at this time. The provisions of the DSRA raised the thresholds, that is, the amounts of drugs necessary for conviction for some first through third degree offenses. We anticipated that that would result in a decline in cases that are first through third degree and that fourth and fifth degree would increase. We have seen a slight increase in the number of first degree offenses compared to previous years and a decline in the number and percentage of second and third degree offenses overall. The provisions of the DSRA created a gross misdemeanor level fifth degree offense. We anticipated, because of those other changes, that the percentage of fifth degree offenses would increase. We have seen a decline in the number and percentage of felony fifth degree offenses, but when the gross misdemeanor fifth degree offenses are added back in, that was an offense that didn't exist before the DSRA. That's the light blue, the 662. You see that the number was greater than the comparison groups in the previous 2 years. Because of the changes in the DSRA that reduced drug thresholds, limited mandatory minimums, and reduced presumptive durations or expanded presumptive probation for some offenses, we anticipated that the percentage of drug offenders who received a departure would decrease. There would be more sentence uniformity. We have seen that mitigated dispositional departure rates have generally decreased across most levels, third degree being an exception. With respect to post-sentence DSRA sentence uniformity for durational departure rates, we also expected more uniformity, and we have seen, in fact, that mitigated durational departures have declined for first through third degree offenses, so the overall rate also declined. With respect to estimated prison beds needed after the Drug Sentencing Reform Act, because of the changes that I've described in the DSRA, we anticipated that the act would result in prison bed savings. And this chart shows the prison beds, estimated prison beds needed for the two groups pre-DSRA by degree. That's the different colors on the bars. And then the post-DSRA group that we've had a chance to look at so far. And the post-DSRA cases that we've studied so far have, in fact, required fewer estimated prison beds than comparable groups of pre-DSRA cases. We also looked at this a different way. We looked at the estimated prison bed demand that was avoided after the Drug Sentencing Reform Act. We compared the actual post-DSRA sentences to sentences of comparable cases sentenced in 2015. So we looked at the post-DSRA cases, looked at how much drugs they were using or possessing or selling, and it appears and basically reassign them sentences if they had been sentenced, if that same case had been sentenced in 2015. And it does appear that the prison bed need would have been about 622 cases, I'm sorry, 622 prison beds greater if the actual post-DSRA sentences had been sentenced instead in 2015. We've seen an increase in post-DSRA stays of adjudication, and that's something we expected to see because the DSRA mandated stays of adjudication for some fifth-degree offenders and permitted stays of adjudication for third-degree possession offenses. Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation. I'm now ready for any additional questions.
Mr. Reitz, I commend you for your speed through it. There are a few questions. I want to spend next about 10 minutes or so, which is not enough, but we may have to continue this conversation into the near future. We have three members that I've got right now, Representative Lesch, Representative Long, and Representative Dean. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Wrights. My first question is related to members of the commission. You had Yami Vang up there. Is she the prosecutor for St. Paul City Attorney's Office?
Mr. Wrights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. Yeah, no, and Yami is great. I like her. She's excellent, but I don't know. She was under the kind of other members of the public or crime victims or whatever, and she's a prosecutor, so I'm not sure if she would, like, double count as prosecutor representation. But just curious. I'm sure there's not people scrambling to get on the commission. My primary question related to the condition that any changes be prospective in application for our modifications of the guidelines. And it related to, so what happens when we legalize recreational use marijuana and there's all these dudes sitting in prison for the same offense? Now, I understand the County Attorney Association is like, no go. Their support is conditioned on us not making any kind of amnesty for folks like that. Because maybe their argument would be, well, that's not our job, and that's fine. But it is our job. It absolutely is our job to think about that, that if we change the law and all of a sudden all these guys are sitting in prison for what's now currently legal, it provides for a very awkward situation for us. Now, how has the commission and how has this committee, because I haven't sat on this committee for 4 years now, how did we deal with that with respect to the last reforms? And maybe we didn't, because like you said, it was not nearly as broad an application as maybe we would have anticipated. Or is there another time in the past that the commission has dealt with that, and you recall how this committee dealt with it?
Director Wrights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, yes, I will confirm that Yami Vang is sitting in a public member seat, so there's no particular qualification or disqualification to be a public member, except that one of the seats also requires the member to be a felony crime victim. She's not sitting in that seat.
Well, let me clarify, Mr. Chair, if I can. I have no problem with Yami Vang. I was just curious if it was the same person.
Okay. Why don't we proceed?
Perfect
Director
person.
Rice.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in 2015, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission recommended a drug offender grid to the legislature, similar to what we're doing this year. But the legislature did not permit that to take effect. Instead, the legislature adopted the 2016 Drug Sentencing Reform Act, which was much more comprehensive than anything the commission could or didn't do. In the course of that, they changed the law with respect to felony sentencing. And each time they changed the law with respect to felony sentencing, they said this law is effective August 1st, 2016, and applies to crimes committed on or after that date. There was no question, as far as the Supreme Court was concerned, as to whom that affected. That affected only offenders whose date of offense was after August 1st of 2016. So a judge may consider that in departing from the guidelines, but there's no legal recourse for an offender who, say, had a subsequent drug offense where the subsequent drug offense mandatory minimum was repealed. Well, if it was committed before August 1st of 2016, sorry, you're out of luck. The subsequent still applies to you. And that was the legislature's choice. But in enacting the drug offender grid, the legislature did not have the magic language applies to crimes committed on or after that date. They just said it's effective when the governor signs his bill. So what the Supreme Court said is unless the legislature specifically says that it's effective for crimes committed on or after a particular date, then it applies immediately to anybody whose case is not final if it's a change that mitigates punishment. So if you, what you're describing is if the legislature were to, say, make the possession or sale of marijuana no longer a crime, I would hope the legislature would have the foresight to be extremely clear in such a law as to when to whom that applied, whether it did apply retroactively or whether it applied prospectively only. Frankly, that would avoid any question and any litigation.
Good advice, Director Wrights. Representative Lesh?
Just thank you. Just not a further question, Mr. Chair, but just as a follow-up, I suspect I know what the prosecutors are going to say about this. They say you can't allow for some kind of post-conviction relief in a reform like that, because we made deals with these people, just like, you know, Al Capone didn't go to prison on racketeering. He went to prison on income tax. But we all know what he was guilty of. So you can't let these violent people out of prison just because we got them, you know, on the drugs, on the marijuana. And I would just submit, Mr. Chair, that when we deal with this, the game cuts both ways. So just as you were talking about the guidelines for second-degree assault, you know, I would seriously doubt there's a I haven't run into a prosecutor in this state who, when someone is charged with a he said, she said terroristic threats and it's headed to trial, they don't amend the charge of second-degree assault, which has a 36-month presumptive commit. And so you're staring down the barrel of 3 years in prison with a zero criminal history score. I'm saying the game applies on both sides, and we need to figure out that if we do legalize marijuana, there's going to be people sitting in prison who maybe shouldn't. We're going to have to deal with the consequences of that, and I hope we will at some point. And I realize, Director Wrights, that you know the courts no longer necessarily have jurisdiction over these people. It's a matter of the sentence passed, but I think this committee will have to work on that.
Chairman Lesh, it's a good observation. I suspect we're going to have a lengthy conversation along these lines in the months to come. I, for one, as chair of this committee and one member of the legislature, things that we need to have a very careful conversation and give ourselves the time to do that. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Wrights, I'm interested in your thoughts on Minnesota's standing on probation. It's my understanding that we have the longest probation sentences on average in the country, and that we are either fourth or sixth in terms of the longest probation percentages in the country, percentage of people on probation. I'm curious why Minnesota is such an outlier, and if the commission is comfortable with our notoriety and that statistics.
Director Wrights, and you alluded to this earlier in terms of what you expect the work that you all be considering at your meeting in February, but please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, I don't really have anything to add to my comments because the commission hasn't spoken, and I don't get in front of the commission as far as policy goes, but I believe that question would be well addressed to the speaker who follows me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Wrights, then curious about early discharge. Wondering if there's a standard practice among counties and judicial districts regarding early discharge practices, and if there's variation that you've seen.
Director Wrights.
Mr. Chair, I think this is something that Rowena has studied, and it's really outside the scope of what the commission has chosen to focus on. It's really chosen to focus on the prison, no prison, prison duration, not so much the probation side of things. Although the legislature did give it the authority to delve into that, it really has limited it to very broad guidance on probation-type decisions. So I don't have a lot to say in that area, Representative Long.
And Director Wrights, I suspect that the legislature wants to be very respectful of the healthy tension that exists in terms of the statute and the work of the guidelines commission. At the same time, I would gander to say that we're pushing into a new public policy direction that may require us to keep this open conversation about expanding the deliberative scope of the guidelines. But we'll flesh that out as we continue to go. Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, Director Wrights, one more question then. The commission did issue a report noting a significant variation by region and offense type in terms of probation, and I'm curious what impact those variations have on racial and geographic disparities, if you could reflect on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, the commission has looked at that, and there certainly has been concern voiced about that. I mean, one of the points of having sentencing guidelines is to reduce disparities, and that does seem to be an area in which there's evidence of disparity.
Very, very good. Representative Long. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Rice. You know, as I look at some of the numbers and some of the things you present and look initially at the graph on slide 24 and then subsequently the slide on 25, this just seems to be sort of a raw number percentage, and there doesn't seem to be any weighting of these numbers relative to proportion of population. And I'd be really, really interested to see what these graphs might look like if you actually did a true weighting of percentage of population, because, you know, this in and of itself on 24 is very, very alarming. But I think if you did something that actually looked at it relation to proportion of population, I think it would tell a very more drastic story. And I don't know if that's something that you all could prepare and present back to the committee at some point.
Director Reitz.
Mr. Chair, in the report to the legislature on page 72, table 11, in Appendix 3, so Appendix 3 is our description of the impact of the proposed 2019 guidelines modifications. If it were a bill, it would meet our requirements to do a demographic impact statement. So we've sort of done a little demographic impact statement on our own modifications to the guidelines. And as part of that statement, we do include a table, and that's what table 11 does, essentially a picture of the demographic characteristics of Minnesota's general population, age 15 and older, the felony population, and the prison population, and compares those three. And then table 12 breaks that down to how the change would impact each of those populations. So we do get into that on a case-by-case basis. We don't have a chart that shows over time. That would be interesting, but I haven't prepared such a short chart, but I do have it for 2017.
Members, we are running over our time here in terms of this particular witness, so let's be very concise. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be interested in what that might look like, even in a short capsule of time, as well as looking at the chart on slide 25. If you actually took the information that's part of the larger report and presented something visually, graphically, that would be easily for people to look at and understand versus going through a table of different cells and things like that to make those comparisons.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Aaron, I want to thank you for the work that you've done. It's been sentencing guidelines has been was developed years ago, but I think it was in the, remember correctly, it was in the 80s.
Late 70s.
Late 70s, to deal with racial disparities. I just done a very well, good job at that. Unfortunately, we have three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the other judicial. The legislative branch has no say over the judges and what they do. So we put together the guidelines to try to keep in the guide rails. But we have no authority to tell the judges where they can go. And I think part of the issue we're having is the downward departures in some areas. So that's something we need to look at. And that was the issue back in the 70s when I just late 70s, early 80s, when I got my career into law enforcement. But as the legislature, we cannot tell judges what to do. And so it's going to be very hard and very difficult for us to figure out how we can do that. We're going to have to work with the judges on their side to help relieve some of the issues. But I do want to thank Mr. Wright for the work he's done, and the sentencing guideline has been very helpful trying to work on these issues.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. We clearly have a lot of work to do, and I, like you, I'm looking for that magical, not magical, but that dynamic way in which we can make sure that the will of the people is being expressed through all branches of our government. Representative Edelson, and then we're going to move on to our next testifier.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Wright, you had said there was an 8% increase in terms of offenders, that was the number with drug offenses with the largest going up. What were the top three drugs that you're seeing?
Director Wright.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, I don't have my drug report in front of me, but I can I'll tell you, meth is blowing everything away. It's by far meth is the winner, and second and third aren't even close.
Representative Reynolds.
Is there a way to get that report? I would love to see that information.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Edelman, all our reports are on the website. We still have a couple more that are coming up, and that's shown here on the last slide. And the drug report is current.
Thank you, Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. And Representative Johnson and I had that similar conversation, I think, a month ago about, and a couple of other members, about the prevalence of meth and the difficulty that's posing for us. Director Wright, thank you. We pushed you to get through a lot of information awfully quickly. I frankly wish we had spent more time with it, but hopefully we could still find some good time up front in the session for us to continue this conversation. Thank you for being here with us today.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair. It was an honor. Thank you.
Members, we're going to move on, and then so we have a half hour left slotted in this committee, so it makes sense to try to do a 15 and 50 split, but we're going to have to move awfully quick. And so next we're going to hear from we're going to hear about the structure and pardon? Oh, we are. Okay. We're going to hear from the Rubina Institute. So is there someone here? Yeah. Okay. Kelly Mitchell, please come forward. And actually, you know, sort of the stars align because you're a former member of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I trust you've been listening carefully to some of the conversation here today, and it probably has something to do with what you want to share with us today. But quickly, let us know who you are, what the Rubina Institute is, and then share your thoughts with us today. We have about 15 minutes.
All right. I'm Kelly Mitchell. I'm the executive director of the Rubina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice. We're located at the University of Minnesota, and we have expertise in sentencing guidelines, probation, and parole. And just to correct the record, I was not a member of the Sentencing Commission, but I was the director. I was the previous Nate Wrights. So anyway,
you were the previous director.
Exactly.
My apologies.
No problem. So I've been asked here to talk about the state of probation, to give us a bit of a picture of where we are and what some of the issues are that the committee might want to talk about during this session. So first I'm going to start off by saying, if you leave Minnesota, if you go anywhere else in the country, and actually in other countries as well, we have a reputation for having one of the lowest incarceration rates in the nation. I've been working in criminal justice since 2001. We used to be the second lowest incarcerator. We're now the fifth lowest. And that's because other states have been working on reforms in that area, and Minnesota's prison population has continued to grow. So that's a different hearing. But we are still doing pretty good. We're fifth lowest in the incarceration rate. But what that doesn't tell us is how many people are actually caught up in the criminal justice system as a whole. And so if we were to take a look at the rate of overall correctional control in Minnesota, we're actually the 13th highest in the nation. So that takes into account people who are in prison, in jail, on probation, on supervised release, on conditional release. So that's everybody. And what this means is that for in Minnesota, 2,810 individuals out of every 1,000 who are 18 or older are under correctional control in some way. And that number is really driven by our probation population. We are fifth highest in the nation for the rate at which we have individuals on community supervision. Community supervision here actually does include those who are serving time in the community post-prison, so our supervised release population, as well as our probation population. So the question then would be, what does that look like in Minnesota? I'm now going to sort of switch to just focusing in on probation. The Department of Corrections here in Minnesota does an annual census of the probation population. So this data is actually taken from them, from their annual census. And what it shows is that we're not at the highest probation population that we've ever had in Minnesota. That peak hit more in around 2007. But we're up there. We're definitely higher than we were two decades ago. At the end of 2017, there were about 98,000 individuals on probation, and that's all types. So that's felony, gross misdemeanor, and misdemeanor. So those, the green line at the top is the total population, and then the other three lines are the type, the offense level. So if we dig into that number to see what kind of offenses are individuals serving probation for, what we see is that over time, our misdemeanor population has gone down dramatically, and that's a good thing. So it's now down to, at the end of 2017, it was at about 22,000, which is less than half of what it was in 2002. But what's happened is that the felony population has steadily increased over time. The gross misdemeanor population has stayed about the same. So we're sort of replacing one kind of probation with another. And the question that we have to ask ourselves is, well, why would that felony population be growing, especially that dramatically over time? So one, so the rest of the time I'm going to focus in on felony probation. That's really where I'm going to focus my time today. So one thing that we know in Minnesota is that we have prioritized community supervision as our primary method of punishment for felony offenses. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. What it means is that we're reserving prison for the individuals who are the most dangerous, who commit the most serious offenses, or who have the longest criminal histories. They're demonstrating a repeated pattern of offending, and at some point, prison is the right punishment for them. So we have that built right into our guidelines. These are two paragraphs that are stated right at the front of the guidelines that put prison as our priority. The shaded part on the grid, those are the folks who are recommended for probation. And if I were to plot all of the felony offenses that were sentenced in the last year on this grid, you'd see that they really fall at severity levels 2 and 4, which are primarily probation levels. So we have a priority for probation. So that's okay, fine. But that doesn't tell us why the population is necessarily growing. So the two things that are going to go into that growth are, number one, how many individuals are being sentenced to probation, and number two, how long are those probation periods for? So this is data actually from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission from one of their recent reports that shows the red bars show individuals who are sentenced to probation. The blue part of the bar are the individuals sentenced to prison. You can see that about 3/4 of all felony offenders annually are sentenced to probation. And so that's a bigger percentage, but the number has grown. It's really hard to see. But in 2001, there were about 8,000 individuals sentenced to probation. By 2015, that number was almost 12,000. So, you know, we're seeing more people. So that's number one. More people are being sentenced to felony probation. And then the second thing is the length of probation. How long are felony probation terms compared to other terms? So if we look at our statute, if we start there, we see that misdemeanor probation is generally 1 to 2 years. We see that gross misdemeanor probation can range from 2 to 6 years. And then felony probation, really the doors are wide open. It could be anything. The statute says 4 years or the statutory maximum sentence, whichever is longer. And so the statutory maximum is the punishment that you all set. When you define a crime, you say this is an offense that's punishable by a maximum of 25 years. If you put that max at 25, that's how long a probation term could be. So how long are they really? If we look at, this is average probation terms for 2010 to 2015. by judicial district. I'm glad that you have the map from the prior presentation so you can look at it. And one thing you can see here is that we have huge variation across the state in terms of what types of, what the length of probation sentences are that are typically ordered. So districts 4 and 6 are Hennepin. Hennepin is 4th, and 6 is the Duluth area. They keep their terms relatively short, and on average, they're just over 3 years long for felonies. But for some of the other districts, including right across the river in the 2nd district, which is St. Paul, Ramsey County, the terms are a lot longer, and they approach about 6.5 to 7 years. Now, that's everybody, right? So let's look under the hood a little bit more. And let's look at average, what the most common lengths of probation are. So that's what this one does. If we took the whole body of individuals sentenced to probation in each judicial district, what are the terms that are making up that 100% for each district? So the first thing you'll see, again, in the 4th and the 6th, the blue parts of those bars are 3-year terms. So the majority of their offenders, over 65%, are getting 3-year terms. For the rest of the state, the most common probation term for felonies is the purple bar, and that's a 5-year sentence. So that's good. That's not too bad. That's actually pretty average. If you look across the country, 5 years is a very average felony cap for probation terms. So then we look into the brown section and the other colors above the brown section. Those are our lengthier terms. And what you can see is that as a state, about 18% of the felony sentences, felony probation terms, were longer than 5 years during this 5-year period. But in some districts, like the 7th, it's 30% of their cases that are getting these much longer probation terms. So I looked just at those to see what the average probation lengths are when you break that 18% down by judicial district. And what we find here, the gray part of the bar, brown part of the bar, is that the most common probation term after 5 years is 10 years. So we don't go 5, then 6, we go 5, then 10. So a lot of people are getting 10-year sentences. And then after that, 15 years is the purple section. 20 years is the green section, and then at the way at the top, that I don't know, olive color, is 25 to 40 years. There's a variation in there. 25, 30, and 40 tend to be the next numbers. So for this period of time, this 5 years, the about 8,700 people received a 10-year probation term, and then another 3,700 received probation terms that were 15 to 40 years long. So what we're seeing here is that not only are we increasing the number of individuals, not only is the number of individuals who are getting felony probation terms going up, but a big percentage of those individuals are receiving pretty lengthy terms. And so what that does in the aggregate is that it means that we're not seeing the turnover. So before, we might have had a lot of individuals who were on misdemeanor probation. Since we've traded places between misdemeanor and felony probation, we're trading those 1 and 2 year probation terms for 5, 10, 15 year probation terms. And so that's why the felony population is growing as much as it is.
Ms. Mitchell, yeah. Being pushed by time, I apologize for that.
Fine.
If we have about 5 more minutes here.
Okay.
I do have a question for Representative Wong coming up as well, but please proceed.
Okay.
And my apologies.
No, it's no problem at all. I'm actually almost at the end here. I've got like 2 slides. This is just to show you that it's not necessarily, you might think that person offenses should be getting the longer probation terms if we're honing in on what those terms are. But it's actually been drug offenses that tend to get the longest terms. DWI also gets longer terms. That's actually legislated in statute what those terms are. So that explains that category. And that brings us to what we know and what we don't know, just to sort of sum this up. What we know, what I've told you, Minnesota does prioritize probation over prison. We know the felony probation has overtaken misdemeanor probation and is continuing to grow. We know felony probation terms are longer than misdemeanor terms. That's part of the reason why that population is growing. We also know that because there's not a lot of guidance in our statute about what those felony terms should be, we have a great amount of variation. So, where sentencing guidelines give us some direction on what the prison terms should be, they give no direction on what the probation terms should be. And so there's a lot, the statute leaves a lot of room there. A couple of things that we don't know that I think you should be aware of. We don't know how long people are actually serving on probation. We know what the sentences are, but we don't know if they're serving that exact length of time or if there are other factors at play. There, a few moments ago, you mentioned early discharge. There was a group that the Senate actually called together a couple of years ago that studied that issue and found that there were early discharge policies throughout the state. But we don't know how much they're being used. We know anecdotally in some places that the court isn't willing to consider early discharge. So we just don't have that data. We also don't know recidivism rates, how many probationers are convicted of new crimes. We don't know how many probationers are revoked. This is data that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has put together that gives us a rough revocation rate for reasons other than a new felony. But there's some problems with it because we don't know if these are technicals or if they are misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor convictions or a combination of both. It could be all of the above, and then we can't add on to that what the recidivism rates are. And then lastly, we don't actually know why probationers fail. We can tell from this that if they do fail, it tends to occur within the first 2 years. So that gives us a sense of where we should be focusing our time, but it doesn't tell us exactly what we should be working on. So why, and I guess the last thought I would leave you with is, why does it matter how many probationers are revoked and what the recidivism rates are? And I would say that that's because it matters because those are our outcome measures. Those are our bellwethers as to how probation is going and what we might need to do to adjust it and make sure it works for Minnesota. So with that,
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Two things very quickly. One, I suspect that part of this last question of why probationers fail has to do with, part of it has to do with some data and data access issues. I see you nodding. Let me also just very quickly ask you a big question, but a quick answer, and we will come back and have a longer conversation. Is it your opinion that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has the authority and the direction to provide clear directions on probation metrics and guidance to our courts?
Mr. Chair, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission certainly has the authority to determine, what set the policy, determine what appropriate probation terms might be, maybe to engraft that onto the sentencing guidelines if that was the desired solution. They also have general authority to report on sentencing information, to work with other agencies to get data so that they can provide better metrics. I'm not sure if they have exactly the authority they would need to get all of the data that could really give us a good picture of what's going on in Minnesota. We did a study when I was the director there where I literally had to write a letter to every probation director to ask for permission to get their data. It wasn't a problem, but that should be, in my opinion, that should be something that they can just do. It shouldn't be a request that has to be made.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Long, and then Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mitchell, thank you for addressing the early discharge question from earlier. I'm struck by the geographic disparities that you're showing in the length of probation terms, and curious what research you know of in terms of the effectiveness of probation terms that are over 5 years.
Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, Unfortunately, there's not been a lot of really good research on that particular question. What does the length of probation matter to recidivism, effectiveness, that sort of thing? Because sort of that research was sort of done all back in the early 90s, and then they moved on to, like, how do we make probation better? And no one has really gone back to it then, and the metrics that were used back then were actually not very good. So we really don't have a good picture of that. But what I find interesting is think about the fact that Hennepin and Duluth have been using three-year terms for quite some time, and the rest of the state's been using really long terms. We don't have any evidence that that's creating a bigger crime problem in one state versus another part, but it is actually a question that we've been asked to look into.
Representative Love.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mitchell, you mentioned that some other states have five-year caps, so that's a common thing for other states. Is it? Are we an outlier in terms of states that don't have a cap on probation?
Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, there are very few states that have nothing, that don't have any cap on probation. So Massachusetts would be one of the other states that gives absolutely no guidance to the courts. Most states have something, whether it's a three-year, five-year, 10-year, a few have 20, but most states have something in their statute that does put a cap. And then in a couple of other states, the lengths of probation are actually incorporated into the sentencing guidelines.
Professor Love.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question. Ms. Mitchell, also interested in your information on criminal history decay and curious what role that plays in sentencing and how that affects racial disparities in terms of sentencing.
Ms. Mitchell.
Chair Mariani and Representative Long, so do you mean the length of time, or does the length of the probation term affect decay? Is that what you're asking?
Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Mitchell, no, I'm asking criminal history's decay is use in the sentencing guidelines. My understanding is that it is not given the weight that it might be in some other circumstances or some other states, and I'm curious how that, what your view of that is in the sentencing guidelines that we have and how that plays out in terms of racial disparities if we have that information.
Ms. Mitchell.
Chair Mariani and Representative Long, I'm not sure if I 100% understand the question, so I'm going to answer the question I think you're asking. And if I'm wrong, we can talk later. But I think what you're asking is up until recently, until actually the report that's in front of you from the Guidelines Commission today, if a person was on probation and they did receive an early discharge, that offense would not decay in their criminal history until the end of their original term. And so a person who had, like, you know, a 15-year term in an outstate area compared to the 3-year term in Hennepin County would see that offense playing into their criminal history for a much greater period of time. Now the rules have been changed to allow for that offense to decay if the person is given an early discharge, or at least that's the proposal that's been put in front of you this year. So I think that's a really good change. I think that it doesn't get at the fact that we have all this disparity and that individuals are being differently affected by the sentences across the state.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again. We worked on so many different things. I'm glad you're here. Something in my studies and work and tours and all the things that I do that has come to my attention is what they're calling administrative probation, and you haven't really touched on that at all. It's not, you know, it's more of a quick check-in. It's minimal supervision. Just wondering if you could speak on that just a minute. And then in sort of the anecdotal information I'm getting out there as I'm out and about and talking to folks from different levels of probation, I keep hearing something like, well, if they're going to reoffend, it's going to be in that first year to 18 months, and after that, they pretty much don't. If you could speak, I guess you said there weren't really any studies, but maybe if you've heard that also anecdotally. And then the last thing, if you could just touch on real quickly, is you know, we have 100,000, as you pointed out, on probation parole, and it was one of the highest in the nation. But that's coming, as I understand it, in the sentencing and from the courts. But what we've done on the probation side, basically, is even if it's a 10 or 20 year probation, like I said, they kind of go to administrative probation, and they don't early discharge as, I guess that's an option too, but they seem to talk more out in the field about administrative. So anyway, if you just cover those two, if you know any more.
Yes, please.
Chair Mariani, Representative O'Neill, good to see you as well. So first of all, I'm really going to let the folks who are in the business of delivering probation talk about the pros and cons of administrative probation. I think that certainly as individuals lower their risk to reoffend and work on those factors that cause them to reoffend, they should be stepped down in terms of the amount of supervision that they're given. Administrative is the lowest you could go, right? There's really, it is minimal check-ins. But I think that one thing to consider is, what's the impact of continuing to remain on paper for that individual's life? Is it more difficult for them to get employment, housing, you know, those sorts of things? Those are the broader impacts. And if a person, in my opinion, if a person has stepped down to that level, it may not be necessary to have to have any supervision over them at all anymore at that point. Now I'm forgetting what the other two were. You're going to have to remind me.
Representative O'Neill.
Yeah, it was just, you had said that there weren't really any studies as to the most effective sort of length of probation. I'm just hearing anecdotally that if they're going to reoffend, it's going to be in that first 18 months.
Ms. Mitchell.
Chair Mariani and Representative O'Neill. Yeah, that is actually the generally accepted view. When individuals reoffend is often one aspect of quantitative research that's done on different populations. They'll often check for that. And usually a reoffense does occur early on. In Minnesota, we don't really have our own numbers to tell us that directly, because we don't really track it in any kind of, deliberate way. I think we could run those numbers, or folks at the DOC especially sometimes could try to run those numbers, but we don't track it in any deliberate way. So we don't have a clear view of when those reoffenses might be occurring.
Thank you. And Chair, just a real quick thing. So last biennium, we passed something called Alternatives to Incarceration, and it's been piloted in Anoka County. And so I really am looking forward to DOC's, it's a flow-through grant through DOC to see what success that has had. So instead of, once they had a technical violation and they were on their way back to prison, instead of doing that, doing drug treatment instead. And so I'm excited to hear that, but that's kind of in the same kind of wheelhouse here. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. We have one more question, and then I'm going to try to get us done when we should be done, or when we scheduled ourselves to be done. Members, I do want to refer you to the rules that I've shared out. One of the rules is that we're going to start promptly. I did not do that today because a good chunk of our committee members were not here. I want you all as members to get to your next appointment on a timely basis. In order for me to do that, you need to be here on a timely basis. So my apologies to the Department of Corrections. They've graciously agreed to come back and share their information at a subsequent meeting. So with that, I'm going to call on Representative Johnson for the last question of our previous executive director of the sentencing guideline. There's some question about whether you were a member or the director of it. And so I just, on the record, want to make sure that that's clear. Representative Johnson, I think you have room for one question and a special one answer.
First of all, I'm wondering if the staff and the members could get a copy of this presentation so we can dive into it a little deeper.
Very well, absolutely, Representative.
And I don't really have a question; it's more of a comment. In Minnesota, we are not the outlier; we are the forward thinkers, because we did this issue that the other states are now looking at doing in the late 70s, early 80s, with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We went to a system of less time in prison, more time on parole. For every two days of your sentence, you get one day off your sentence for good time. But we did lengthen the probation area to make up for that difference. So, yes, we do have longer probations, but we have a lot less time that they're sitting in the prison system and in the county jail system. One thing I noticed on slides 11 and 12, it showed the, especially in Hennepin County and in Duluth, a difference in the amount of time on probation. But one thing I noticed was missing is, what was the type of crime? If there's a lot of lower-level crimes, probation is going to be a lot less. If there are more severity crimes in other areas, their longer probation time is going to be a lot less, a lot more. So we have to, as a committee, we have to dive in the numbers a whole lot more to actually get the answers. Basic numbers can be misleading. And as other states are changing, they're changing to the system that we have, that we put into place decades ago. So I think we got to be real careful how we look at this and make sure any changes we do, they are the proper changes. Because we want to make sure that we protect our citizens of Minnesota.
Ms. Mitchell, I'll let you have the last word here.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Johnson. You're absolutely right that where other states are getting to today is where we are now. They're working on lowering their prison populations, on making the kinds of judgments that we made a long time ago about prison being only for those more serious offenses. But they're also working on probation, and that's one thing that I think that other states are a little bit ahead of us in. There are other things going on in other states, for instance, not allowing individuals to be revoked to prison for technical violations, only reserving that for new crimes, or limiting the amount of time that individuals might serve if they do need an incarcerative sanction for violations. So there's still places that we could go. And just in terms of Hennepin County versus arrest, actually Hennepin would be like a microcosm of the whole state because they are the largest county with the largest volume of felony offenders in the state as a whole. They don't look different in terms of the rest of the state. They're actually probably more representative of the total types of offenses that we see across the state, all right within that same one county.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. I appreciate your patience with our moving around in the schedule. More importantly, I appreciate your work at the Rubino Institute in preparing for today's hearing. Members, we're going to meet again tomorrow. We have a joint meeting with Chairman Considine's Subcommittee on Corrections. We will also be meeting in room 120. Of the Capitol. It will much better accommodate, the larger, numbers of folks that will come together as the committee and subcommittee meet in common. And we will be turning room 120 into our default meeting room. So please factor that in as you set up your schedule, throughout the day. I think we're back here for Thursday's hearing. And then the idea is for the subsequent weeks to make room 120 of the Capitol our default room. It doesn't mean we won't meet here, but generally that's where we're going to be meeting. That room will provide us with the video and television access so that we can expand the opportunity for folks across Minnesota to not only hear us and hear from you individually, but also to see us via television. With that, members, I know Representative Johnson, you've got a question, but it's already 5 over. I'm going to adjourn us, and I'll see you all tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank you for moving the committee room where the public can hear us.
Thank you.